The Bay Area Reporter is 50 years old. Welcome to Out in the Bay, Queer Radio from San Francisco. I'm Eric Jansen. This year, the Bay Area Reporter newspaper and online news outlet celebrates 50 years of serving the LGBTQ community. It's a big deal that any independent media outlet can mark a significant anniversary this year, as the COVID pandemic has put even more strain on publications in an already tough competitive industry. It's even more of a big deal for an outlet covering LGBTQ news. The Bay Area Reporter, the BAR for short, started in 1971 as a bar rag weekly newspaper covering San Francisco's gay bar culture and grew over the decades into one of the most influential LGBTQ news publications in the country. It has the largest readership of any LGBTQ news outlet and is also the longest continuously published. With me to talk about this milestone are news editor Cynthia Laird and publisher Michael Yamashita. Mr. Yamashita was born in Hawaii and graduated from Santa Clara University. He joined the BAR as a copy editor in 1989, was named general manager in 1995 under founding publisher Bob Ross, and was named publisher in 2013. In 2017, after acquiring all shares held by investor partners, Yamashita became the first gay Asian Pacific Islander owner-publisher of an LGBTQ newspaper. He serves on the board of directors of the California News Publishers Association and the National LGBT Media Association. And outside of journalism, he's long been involved in the Bay Area Hawaiian community as a teacher of history, music, culture, and hula. Michael Yamashita, welcome to Out in the Bay.
Hi, Eric. Thanks for having me, having us, and turning the tables on us for a change.
All right. Cynthia Laird has been with the Bay Area Reporter for 25 years. A graduate of Cal State University Sacramento with a degree in government and journalism, she started with the BAR as an assistant editor in 1996, about a month after the paper's 25th anniversary. Since becoming news editor in 1999, Laird has worked to include more articles pertaining to LGBTQ communities of color, the transgender community, queer youth, and more. She enjoys cooking, especially baking. Welcome, Cynthia Laird.
Thanks for having us, Eric.
Thank you both for joining us, and congratulations to you and all of the BAR staff on this half-century milestone. So let's start at the BAR's roots. Michael, let's start with you on this. Who started the Bay Area Reporter and why?
Well, that was before my time, even though I've been here since 1989. The story is it started between two people, Bob Ross and Paul Bentley. He was a friend and business partner, and also had the help of many other friends who were in the bar scene and bar business at the time. And they put together a newsletter for the bar patrons and to organize the gay bars in the day under the Tavern Guild. And it developed into a newspaper and into a business. And here we are 50 years later.
Yeah, the Tavern Guild was like a very influential organization at that time. And I found this article just this morning from by Michael Flanagan in your March 30th edition. I want to read just a little bit from it because it talks about how this paper did not grow out of the gay liberation movement, but from the bars. It says the bars were the source of political power in San Francisco for nearly a decade at the time Stonewall happened in Manhattan. That was 2 years before the BAR started. And unlike the East Coast bars, many San Francisco bars had gay owners. So it really did have that bar start. And also I want to read a little section for the very end of this article by Michael Flanagan. It mentions that just within a year after its founding, one of the gossip columnists was assigned to cover Marin, the peninsula, and the East Bay for his beat, and the inclusion of news from around the Bay Area made the BAR a better paper, but it couldn't hold off news from around the country and the world. And the following year, the paper would deal with the election of Richard Nixon, increased vice squad raids, and increasing violence against the community. The notion that the paper could simply be one that dealt with bar news seemed somehow quaint as the pace of the 1970s picked up. So yeah, it's really like it might have wanted to be just a gay bar rag gossip column, but it couldn't do that. Do you know if in the early days there was a plan, like a development plan, to move it forward into broader coverage, or it just sort of happened organically?
Oh, definitely it was an organic development. A lot of what you mentioned is true, that a lot of organization or organizing actually was happening among the bar owners before Stonewall, basically organizing against mafia ownership and police influence in the bar business itself, right? Gay bar business. And I think the political developments really necessitated the paper reaching out beyond the bar scene strictly and to cover real political news and dire news for the community, because at the time, a lot of the news locally was discrimination in housing, employment, this kind of thing. Gay bashings were a big problem in those days. So we really had more immediate problems to deal with in terms of safety. And the paper really did not start out to become a business, did not really have that in mind. It just kind of fell into that. And at a certain point, Bob Ross realized that, hey, this might be a viable business. So he did bring in people who had business experience in order to turn it into a business with paid employees, benefits, incorporated the business. So it really grew on its own, but definitely no plan was ever made at the very beginning. And Bob himself would have admitted that he was an accidental publisher as well.
Okay, fair enough. So, Cynthia, let me turn to you now. Well, both of you actually can answer this question. How are you celebrating 50 years? And first, why is 50 years a big deal? If you can put that in the context of the publishing business, especially with the current challenge.
Well, I think with the onslaught of Craigslist ads more than a decade ago, really signaled a shift in all publications, really, that depended on advertising revenue. And we are entirely dependent on paid advertising, and used to have pages and pages of classified advertising, personal ads, all that kind of stuff in the back of the paper. I remember when I was working there in the mid-90s, on Monday mornings, the guys would line up out the door to come in and place their personal ads for that week. I mean, it was just, I'd never seen anything like it. So Craigslist kind of decimated the classified advertising. And then, you know, we've had the dot-com bust. We had the recession. Those all kind of ate into regular display advertising. And then, of course, COVID last year was a big hit, because a lot of the venues that would advertise with us weren't open.
I know it's been especially bad with all the kinds of entertainment ads. Tell us about the ongoing retrospective. Every week for 50 weeks now, you're featuring articles from 1 year of the paper, starting with 1971, working your way up to the present. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. And it's been fun to go through the archive and look and pick out which one I want to use. I started with a cover of Dianne Feinstein, because she was early on had been supported by the paper, and even long before she was mayor, when she was a supervisor. So I used that one the first week, and then have just kind of mixed it up with harder news. This week we used to give a lot of coverage to the imperial court and the campaigns for emperor and empress. So this week I used, 1 week we did all the emperor candidates, and the next week they did the empress candidates. So I used those two this week. It's been fun. I hope it gives readers a chance to go look at our archive. We have all of our early issues are digitized, and this feature is also a way to promote that.
Yeah, I looked at a few of them last week, and it's kind of impressive to be able to flip through some of the pages of the early, early days and see that it really was a very different publication than it is today. But those ads, they're interesting. And the one I wrote was the sort of fight about the Mr. Cowboy contest, I think it was. So, of course, the BAR's pages have reflected news and culture and society at large, as they do now, and they have, you know, for 50 years. What are some of the most significant events and coverage over the past half century?
Well, I would say the AIDS epidemic is probably the most significant. I think that really changed how the community had to deal with the pandemic way before the current one. And we've taken some lessons from that into COVID. I think discrimination, like Michael was talking about earlier, was also a big focus of our early issues, whether it be housing and employment or gay bashings. And just the lack of federal equality protections, which continues to this day, is a huge issue.
One thing people forget about, because it happened in our early history, was that Harvey Milk was our first political columnist before he even contemplated running for office. And he gave up the column when he became a serious candidate for supervisor, and he won. Since that, we've always focused on politics and political news, especially City Hall news.
So when did mainstream media start to cover LGBTQ issues significantly and consistently? And the reason I'm asking that question is I also want to lead up to the question of, as the mainstream news media began to cover queer issues more, how does a queer publication stay relevant and cover that news in a different way?
I think when Ronald Reagan finally said AIDS, I think that's when the mainstream media really kind of increased coverage, started to increase coverage. I think it really took off in 2004 when Gavin Newsom, as mayor here in San Francisco, ordered city officials to issue marriage licenses to same-sex couples. From then on, you saw just this kind of explosion of coverage in the mainstream papers, mostly about marriage equality, but some of the other issues kind of filtered into those publications also. I think Gays in the Military was also a big thing that a lot of mainstream publications covered. Don't Ask, Don't Tell, as they would see gay and lesbian people in their hometowns who were, you know, booted from the military because they were gay or lesbian and that sort of thing. That kind of puts a human face on an issue for readers in outside these big urban cities. And other issues, other court cases, when we got rid of the Defense of Marriage Act, that was a big deal. And also the Lawrence decision that overturned all the state sodomy laws.
And that was back in like 2003, I believe.
That was 2003, yeah.
So then with mainstream publications starting to cover these issues more, how did the BAR and other LGBTQ newspapers, how did that change how you had to cover things, or did it?
Well, I don't really think it changed it for us so much. We kept doing what we were doing, but what that meant was, you know, we always talked to LGBTQ people for our stories. And you can see that now in the anti-trans laws that are filtering across the country. A lot of these stories in mainstream papers don't talk to trans people. We make it a real conscious effort to try to get the voices in the paper, in the stories that are affected by whatever issue we're writing about. So queer youth will find some queer young people to talk to. We've done a lot on homelessness. We find queer homeless people to talk to. And trans and people of color. We've just been really doing that a lot, I'd say, probably for the last decade or so. We've really, I think, stepped it up.
I think Cynthia's right. We've really continued to do what we do, but more consciously, we're really focusing on local stories and the local angle to stories, because we know that's where readers are and what they're interested in, and we're probably the only ones to provide the LGBTQ perspective on these issues. And although the mainstream press may cover the same stories, they certainly don't do it consistently or in depth as we do. We may follow certain court cases week to week, whereas the mainstream papers will only write their stories at the end and do a wrap-up. But also, you know, when budgets are cut, these kind of special beats are the first things to go. So there's no reliability that there'll be sustained coverage just because they're reporting on LGBTQ issues now. But also, you know, newsrooms have their own standards that may preclude even LGBT people from reporting on LGBT stories. We know this is a problem with African-American writers who are taking off beats, especially regarding protests, because their editors feel that they can't be objective. So there's a lot of work that mainstream news outlets need to do, and it leaves room for us to continue filling that space.
You're listening to Out in the Bay, queer radio from San Francisco. I'm Eric Jansen with publisher Michael Yamashita and news editor Cynthia Laird of the Bay Area Reporter, Northern California's largest circulation LGBTQ newspaper and online news service covering LGBTQ communities since 1971. We're talking about the BAR's half century of service. I want to take a quick moment to thank a few of our generous donors. This week, Bud in San Francisco, Cornelia also in the Bay Area, and John in Delano, California. That's in the San Joaquin Valley and birthplace of the United Farm Workers, by the way. We're independent and nonprofit. You can join John, Cornelia, and Bud in helping bring queer air to your ears with a tax-deductible gift of any size at outinthebay.org. That's outinthebay.org. We thank you. So I want to move on and ask you a little bit about how people consume their media has changed, you know, news consumers, if we can call them that. Most of the BAR's history is as a newspaper, but today you have far more online readers than print newspaper readers. The last figure I saw was 150,000 online readers versus about 70,000 still reading the newspaper. Is that right, approximately?
Yes, that's true.
And it seems like there's more, there's a higher volume of content and frequency online as opposed to a weekly paper. So how do you describe the BAR now in a few words? Is it a news outlet? What's the industry jargon for something that's doing, you know, you're doing multiple things now?
I'd probably say news outlet's a good description. We've had to grow along with technology like everyone else. The website was a necessity. We came to it quite late, actually, compared to other publications, but we soon realized that the website is another platform and is not a newspaper, so it has to be treated differently and uniquely, as well as other assets that we have, like our Facebook page, a Twitter account, Instagram. We're also in development of a phone app to attract younger readers, because we know that there's a growing number of younger readers who are consuming their news on their phones. So these are all different platforms to reach our readers where they are and how they like to consume the news. Really, we're just adding platforms to our existing one, which was print. Print is the mothership, let's say, of our enterprise here, but it really is about all these different platforms and adding them as they're useful to readers.
I'm curious, you know, I picked up a copy of the BAR last week, and it's a lot thinner than it used to be. And I don't know if that's sort of a temporary thing because of pandemic times and you just don't have the advertisers to support that print run, or if it's a more of a decision that you don't need to have as large of a print paper as previously.
Well, certainly it's a function of the advertising. The amount of advertising will determine the amount of pages. I made a commitment at the beginning of the COVID shutdown that we would not stop publication. Our record is unblemished. I mean, we made it through the Loma Prieta earthquake. Even when the office lost electricity, we still came out with an issue on Thursday. And we were not going to cease publication because of COVID. I mean, we might have gone out of business because of it, but we weren't going to stop publication. But we made it through, and we've definitely switched gears to emphasizing the web because we saw immediately the migration of readers to the online publication, and they're following us online. We have a newsletter that reaches our readership 5 days a week. We try to keep contact with our readers so that they don't forget about us, and it seems to be working.
I just wanted to add on for the website, and especially since the pandemic started, the news site, at least, it seems like we've been even busier than before because we're posting stories constantly now, almost every day. Some of those will never make it in the print issue, and we just want to keep getting the news out to people. When the pandemic first started, we did a lot of stuff to let readers know what was shutting down or what was canceled. As time has gone on, you know, we've just been busy keeping readers apprised of COVID-related things and other news, and we just try to get the stories up as soon as we can online.
And it seems like a great service. I mean, you know that every weekday, basically, you'll get, if you sign up for the email newsletter, you'll get a bulletin with current queer news. You don't have to wait for the end of the week or Thursday for it to come out.
Yes, that's right.
The news industry in general has gone more towards online by necessity. And it seems like every news page that I go to, whether it's a newspaper or a TV station or a radio station, they'll immediately be like, okay, you can read one article for free, but then you've got to pay for it. So you're still not requiring people to pay for it, but you are encouraging people to sign up for a membership. Tell us about that membership model.
Well, actually, it's a two-step process. We do allow you to read 5 articles a month free. After that, we require you to sign up for the newsletter, which then will give you unlimited access to the online articles.
But there's no cost for that still. You can still sign up for the email newsletter for free. You just have to sign up. You got to give your email address in order to keep getting it for free.
Exactly.
That's fair.
And for those who are generous enough, we do offer memberships either annually at $100 or $10 a month. And it's simply a way for our readers to support our work here. And I'm really grateful that our readers have really stepped up to support the work that we do.
Cynthia, as news editor, are there any stories, looking back over the past, 25 years since you've been there, are there particular stories or issues or organizations or people that come to mind in your coverage that have really, you know, affected you personally?
Oh, that would be probably a long list. I think we have prided ourselves on covering all the various LGBTQ and HIV/AIDS nonprofits. Those provide a lot of services to many, many of our readers, and we like to hold them accountable in good times and not so good times. You know, we promote their programs and we take a look at their finances, or, you know, we'll mention they have a new ED, or maybe there's some kind of something going on with why the old one left, you know, but I think the readers really deserve to know that. They're asked all the time to give money to these groups, and I think that we help hold them accountable. And we kind of keep an eye on the goings on in the Castro, because that's kind of our, you know, base. Right now there's a lot going on with the plans for Harvey Milk Plaza and the F-Line streetcar. I really kind of like being hyper-local in that way. I think people really care about the city and care about the Castro, and our readers kind of turn to us to see what's going on there.
And the issue with the F-Line is that they're talking about shutting it down for 4 years or something like that?
Yes. It's been shut down since the pandemic started, so the plan is to bring it back May 15th, only to shut it down again, possibly, for years.
I'm sure Castro businesses are thrilled about that.
It's a lifeline to bring tourists. Everyone loves riding those old streetcars. And there's even one dedicated to Harvey Milk that has history about him on the inside on these little placards and stuff. It's really cool.
Michael, any particular stories that come up in the past that really that pop to mind as ones that affected you or you found most pivotal in some way?
Well, what comes to mind immediately is our famous No Obits headline. The first week that we didn't have any obits submitted to the paper, it really was a turning point, I think, in just the mood and the psyche of San Francisco, because for the first time, there was a glimmer of hope that maybe the protease inhibitors were going to work, and there was light at the end of the tunnel.
So was that No Obits headline towards the end of the worst of the AIDS crisis?
August 13th, 1998. So it was like 2 years after the protease inhibitors. They were announced at the AIDS conference in 96, I believe.
You still have a policy of running obituaries for free, which most newspapers don't do. Why are you still doing that?
I think it's part of our tradition. We run them now for people who have not just passed away due to HIV or AIDS. You know, anyone who turns in one will run it with a photo. I think it started because when the AIDS epidemic was going on, a lot of people were disowned by their family and couldn't express their grief or mourning for their lost partner or loved one in an obituary, in another publication. And I think that's one of the great things that Bob Ross did, was institute that policy. And we used to have a full-time staff member dedicated to the obituaries. That has not been the case for many, many years. And we don't have them every week anymore, but, you know, I'll run them when I get them.
I'd like to add, too, that You know, running photographs with the obituaries was a really important thing for us because back in the day, many people did not really know other people's names. You'd really recognize them in the clubs, in the gyms, in the cafes, in the neighborhood. So you'd know people just on sight, but you might never know them personally or their names especially. So running photographs was a really important aspect of the obituaries because it really informed people who was dying. And, you know, you probably knew more people than you knew names. And that was critical for passing on information, but also part of the community building that happened, or relationships, right, that we were losing. So photographs were always a necessary part of the obituaries as we were concerned. So,
very good. Before we wrap up, we talked earlier about, you know, you're doing a retrospective 50 weeks, 50 years over 50 weeks, and you mentioned the archives. What's the best way for people to find the archives if they want to go back and look at a particular year, just sort of browse through past years of not just the BAR, but the history that is reflected in the BAR's pages?
There are links on the top of the web page on the navigation bar. You'll see archives and current issues. There are two different tabs, but either one will take you to either the deep archives or the more recent publications.
And there's a 50th anniversary tab as well, I think, over on the right-hand side. What does that get people to?
That actually links to all the articles that we ran in our 50th anniversary. A lot of those articles look back at the history of different aspects of the paper, different personalities, and coverage in the arts, and a lot of history.
Very good. As we hopefully cross our fingers, start to emerge from this pandemic, do you have a sense that there are brighter days ahead for the publication? Are you like hanging on by a thread, or do you feel fairly secure, confident?
Well, things are turning around definitely now that people are getting vaccinated, and we certainly feel that in terms of an uptick in advertising. So that's been gratifying after a year of worry and privation, let's say. Anyhow, things are looking up. We're really enthusiastic about the potential for this summer. It really feels like it might turn around. I'm confident we'll be in a better place at the end of this year than we were last year, for sure.
Cynthia, you want to add anything to that?
No, I'm feeling pretty confident. Mike has done a great job kind of leading us through this last year. And, you know, I can't say that there weren't times when we were all kind of wondering what was going to happen. But I think that we're past that, and I think there'll still be plenty of news for us to cover.
Fantastic. Hey, well, thank you very much. I really appreciate your time. You've been listening to Out in the Bay, Queer Radio from San Francisco. My guests were Cynthia Laird, news editor, and Michael Yamashita, publisher of the Bay Area Reporter, Northern California's largest circulation LGBTQ newspaper and online news service, celebrating 50 years of covering queer news and culture. Congratulations again on that accomplishment, and thank you for being here with us out on the Bay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
In our partnership with the Bay Area Reporter, we have a short article on the BAR's website most Fridays with a link to our feature program for the week. Check it out at ebar.com. That's ebar.com. And roughly once a month, a BAR journalist comes on Out in the Bay to fill us in on important stories in the queer community. Be sure to visit outinthebay.org, where you can hear this show again and hear past shows. Please share them with friends. You can also sign up for our weekly e-news and subscribe to our podcasts. Please do, as growing numbers could help us secure funding. We are always open to donations, too, of course. Just hit the donate button on our website. Once again, it's outinthebay.org. Out in the Bay is an independent production. We receive no financial support from NPR nor from the radio stations that broadcast our program. We do thank those stations, though, KSFP and KALW in San Francisco, for bringing us back on the air. Thanks also to Holly Mead for writing and performing our theme music, and to my co-producers, Kendra Klang and Porfirio Rangel. I'm Eric Jansen. Thanks for listening, and thanks for joining us out in the Bay. Thank you.